I need a new computer.
You just got a new computer.
I know. I don't ever not need a new computer.
It's true. Build the next one.
No, too much work.
Start the game already!
So how much have you had to drink in the last, week or two?
Probably not as much as would make me happy.
Clearly. I mean, you look absolutely ecstatic.
Well, it's been a good week, you know. As much as I'm sure everyone in the world is like, oh my God, democracy is over. It's like, no, it's 4 years of Darth Cheeto again. You know, disappointing in a lot of ways, and eventually it'll just be over.
Yeah. I've, not for those reasons, entirely, but I've actually had a lot to drink in the past couple of weeks. I hinted at it, I think, when we recorded last, and that cast episode isn't out yet, but my mom passed a couple weeks back, a little bit more now, and we've just had these functions going on since then. We had a celebration of life for her, sort of the final function, I guess, on, Saturday, and it was a nice event. There must have been 200 people that kind of came in. Was hosted at the Golf and Country Club in Picton, where they ran the restaurant. But after they filtered in and then filtered out, we just kind of had the family there for a while. And my stepfather, who's Scottish, we busted out the Scotch.
Mm-hmm.
You know, decent Scotch, not great Scotch, Glenfiddich.
Mm-hmm.
And had quite a bit of it. Shots at the table, toasting my mom, seeing her off, and it's been a while since I've done that, you know?
It hurts now, doesn't it?
It wasn't too bad the next day, but it certainly hit me more than it used to. Like, I honestly don't have to drink too much now, and it hits me like a truck.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, it's a habit like anything else, right? Your body gets used to it.
Yeah, I think maybe even just as I age, there's sort of a natural kind of,
yes,
I don't know what you call it, softness.
You are no longer a nerd man.
I mean, I've always been a big guy, and because of my size, it used to take quite a bit. I'd have to have, I don't know, 3 or 4 tall boys before it's like, ooh, I got a nice buzz going. And then 20 ounces of hard liquor later, it's like, yep, I'm drunk. Mm-hmm. And now, because of this show, like, I get a couple of tall boys in and it's like, oh yeah, I'm pissed out of my tree. This is great.
I have to pick up my wife. I have to drive across town. I mean, across town. You've been to town. It's not that far. It's, I don't know, 5 minutes, and that includes warming up the car in 3 hours. And I'm looking at, I poured myself a drink, and I'm thinking, I really hope there isn't a ride check. Not because I'll be over the legal limit, because I won't be, but because it'll be, they'll ask if you had anything to drink, it'll have to say, yes, I had a drink a few hours ago. And then it's, you know, blow into the thing and to be at it, just the time, right?
Next time we're together, ask my wife about her most recent experience going through a traffic stop turned breathalyzer test. Quite funny.
I had an incident back when we were working at Stream, before they were a Selectron company. What was the bar across the road called? It used to be Pape Steakhouse, and then it was something.
It was one of the Wahoos for a while, wasn't it?
Yes, it was the Wahoo too. Yeah, so I went across, it's basically like an old railroad car that got converted into a bar and extended out, yada, yada, yada. Seated maybe 50 people if you crowded in, right? So after work one night, I mean, I was working the night shift or the afternoon shift. So it was about, it wasn't quite last call, but it was close. I went and I had a beer and I was there for probably 2.5 hours, you know, playing pool, video games, just shooting the shit. And I came out. And started driving down the road, and someone pulled up so close behind me that I literally couldn't see their headlights. And they were speeding. I'm like, oh shit, they're going to hit me, right? So I swerved, and then the flashing lights come on and he pulls me over. And the reason that he gave for pulling me over was that I swerved and he thought I was drunk. I'm like, buddy, you do that to anyone, they're going to swerve. Right. Anyway, so. And it turned out that was, you remember the strike that the MTO went on around that time? So I had actually transferred, because it was my dad's car, it was the Honda Civic, and he had transferred the car to me, right? And I had done all the paperwork, but it had never gotten filed in the computer. So I had my plates from my old Mazda on the Honda, right? So he runs my plate and he's like, you're driving a stolen car. And I'm like, I'm sorry, what?
This so was I'm what, like 2001-ish, maybe?
Yeah, 2002, 2003, because we were in the new building at that point. And I'm sitting in the back of a cruiser going like, what in the hell is going on? Right? Like, I've never shoplifted a chocolate bar. Like, I'm so fucking straight arrow that when I accidentally do something wrong, I'll be like, I'm sorry, I have to report myself. I did the wrong thing. Right. And here I am in the back of a cruiser. He's literally writing down the paperwork to charge me for stealing this car. I'm like, what? No. Anyway, I mean, it all worked out in the end. He's like, okay, so like, oh, how do you explain this? I'm like, I don't know. Like, it was my dad's car and this and that. And these are the plates from that car. And I'm describing like everywhere that everything came from. And he's like, okay, yeah, those plates are from that car that is in your name still. And I'm like, well, it shouldn't be because I junked that car. And he's like, oh, okay, so this happened during that time and they were on strike. Okay, well, you're going to have to go back to the MTO because they haven't filed the paperwork yet. I'm like, I thought I was going to jail.
I can kind of picture you in the back of the cruiser. That's funny.
Yeah.
Like literally shitting yourself.
Yeah, almost, yeah. Well, and the funny thing too, right, is he pulled me over because I was drunk. So I blew 0.00. And he's like, all right, you're going to have to try that again. 0.00. I'm like, dude, I had one beer like 3 hours ago.
That's kind of like Tanya's experience, and I'm going to have to spoil it a little bit because it was sort of a similar situation. She was pulling off of the 401 in Trenton to take her friend home, would be Glenn Miller Road. And it was like dark, trying to figure out what lane they needed to be in. They were going to be turning off basically just south of the highway. And she switched lanes kind of, I'll say aggressively, so that she wasn't in the wrong lane as they were going through an intersection. And I guess the cop lit her up and she was feeling it. You know how Tanya is sometimes, where she's just in a funny, good mood.
Mm-hmm.
They hadn't had a thing to drink. Like, they did have dinner in Belleville and was taking her friend home. And he pulled her over and she treated it like a joke, like, you know, where most people would be like, oh, no, I didn't drink anything, or they'd get defensive or whatever. She was like cracking jokes about sucking on the breathalyzer and giggling. The two of them were giggling in the front seat. So, of course, this cop thought that they were both pissed out of their tree. Right. And she's like, nope, 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 nope. And she finally gave her the breathalyzer. And that was a bit of an ordeal. And I'll let her get into the expanded version of the story. But again, 0.000. And he seemed almost offended, I guess, or shocked.
Yeah.
And then it's like, no, I told you. Anyway.
Just high on life, man.
Well, and, you know, in their case, I mean, this is a couple of women having a good time, right? And I guess he was probably a little bit hot, the cop, which added to the situation. So they were sort of playing it up. Well, no, my wife was playing it up. Her friend was in the passenger side, just like, shut up, Tanya, shut up, Tanya. You're going to get us in trouble. Shut up, Tanya. Anyway, I mean, if I did what she did, I would be in jail probably still.
Oh, most likely. Yeah.
Yeah.
You'd still have baton marks on your face.
Yeah.
So that was probably the longest pre-kick credit sequence we've ever done.
Yeah. So what are you drinking? You said you had one drink in front of you.
I have one drink in front of me. It's also a meal. So I have made myself something that's martini-esque. It's gin and tonic with some olives in it.
Can tell your wife isn't home if that's your meal.
I did actually have dinner beforehand. She left me leftovers. My wife is awesome.
Well, I've got two things on the go, and I'm not sure which I want to do first. The first one is a Goodbye Gravity by Imperial City. It's a cream ale with Madagascar vanilla. It has a little character on the front of Canadian National Treasure Chris Hadfield. Oh. Commander Chris Hadfield. Yeah, I don't know. That looks absolutely tasty. The other one, which I hinted at last week, is Chalky Walky Chocolate Milkshake Stout Strong Beer.
I would go for the Commander Chris Hadfield Goodbye Gravity first. That's worth it just for the can.
Yeah. I mean, this one's amazing, too. Like, it's just got this little Wookiee-looking dude. I assume it's supposed to be a Sasquatch or something, but from Cameron's Brewing in Oakville. And the other one, Goodbye Gravity, is Sarnia, I believe, is where the brewery is. Shout out Canadian craft beer industry, man.
They're killing it.
All right. Goodbye Gravity it is. So I have a confession to make.
Uh-oh.
I've been lazy the past, I don't know, couple months, really. I've had shit on the go. So we've made a joke in the past about preparing these show docs and how, like, basically I would do it and you would show up. And we've gone in, like, recent memory 180 degrees in the opposite direction. Where you fill out a bunch of notes and now I've kind of come in and refine them a little bit, massage them, maybe add my piece. I don't see the problem. I like it. Maybe you feel a little bit different about it. But without actually saying it, you had the interesting idea of having a podcast episode about podcasts. you know, your topic was a little bit more specific, and I suppose I should explain that. While I'm talking about my wife glowingly, she's a passionate woman. And she's, I mean, she has great ideas. And, like, you know, when she has an idea, it's a banger. It is.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking like 2 in the morning. Her sleep schedule's a little bit out of whack, just the work situation changing, some of her health stuff that she's had going on. She's sleeping a little bit more during the day, which has her awake at night. Which has created an interesting dynamic between the two of us, because as I'm coming to bed after work, after, you know, doing dinner and stuff like that, like, I'm rolling in, it's 11 o'clock, midnight. It's like, okay, I got to get up in the morning. And I can't remember if this was the night that I had to get up at like 5 in the morning. Maybe not, but it's like 2 in the morning. And she's like, I just had this amazing idea and we need to talk about it right now. She's been getting chatty like at, you know, 1 or 2 in the morning, which is great. This is great. It's funny. But her idea was, I'm going to start a podcast and I need to start it with Telson. You know, after we recorded last time, gave you the heads up. It's like, just so you know, my wife has the wheels turning and she might come to you about it. Never telling you as if it's like a bad thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
But her basic idea was, like, she had a whole thing. This is what the podcast is going to be called. And this is why Telson needs to be part of it, because he'd be sort of this perfect foil for me, blah, 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 blah. So first of all, before we get into what we wanted to talk about, I guarantee you, if she were to start a podcast, it would, like, instantly be way more popular than ours.
Yes. You know,
deservedly so. It's the kind of thing that I've been suggesting to her that she should do for a long time. I mean, she has all the skills. She has the right attitude for it. But even more, like, primal than that, she has the voice for it. Mm-hmm. We've talked about it when we were doing our Battle of the Nerds thing. Yeah, where I brought in the ringer to record my little noir thing, but she's got that voice.
What? That's now, like, hang on a second. Now, let's not put too fine a point on it. You cheated.
What I would say is I took advantage of the resources that were available to me in a way that was not clearly defined by the rules of engagement.
Oh, absolutely. You absolutely obeyed the letter of the law, but you violated the spirit of the law violently and with egregious action.
Yeah, 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 whatever. You violated the letter of the law. You were way too long. So there, we're even. Anyway. The point is my wife has one of those voices where it's somewhere between, like, warm and inviting, and like hot and sexy at the same time, you know, where she could basically be reading you the phone book and you're like, should I be turned on right now?
She has a good voice for radio, for sure.
Yeah. So really, her doing any podcast, the reality is being a woman with a hot voice and then, of course, being naturally funny and intelligent and stuff, like there's no way in hell she wouldn't just immediately exceed any expectations that we have for where our own show would go. And I wouldn't be jealous. Like, that'd be amazing. So this probably will happen at some point. So I ran it by you, said, this is what she's thinking, just so you know, she's probably going to bring it up. Just to give you a chance to think about it. And, you know, if you're interested or not, doesn't matter to me, but you could be diplomatic in your answer or whatever. And you, because of that, started thinking about like podcast guests and stuff like that who would be good guests on her show. I assume thinking that, you know what, like you're all in on the idea, but you're probably not in on, or you think it needs to have a, you know, like interchanging guests for whatever her concept was, which is good.
Yeah, I'm like, my thinking was, is it like, I'd love to do it, but I think that very much, like, it would very quickly become, I'm not enough of a guest.
Yeah. So taking that sort of very specific discussion point and just backing up a little bit, I mean, I want to talk about, like, you know, who would be good guests on a podcast in general, who we think would be good guests on our own podcast if we were to have guests. Some of this is just, you know, pie in the sky dream kind of situation, right? Like idolization of people. Some of it is like, oh, no, that would actually be entertaining and good.
Yeah, I don't. Here's the thing. It's been, what, 2 weeks since we recorded? Did we record last week?
I think so. We've got one in the hopper that I haven't finished editing yet. Whether that was last week or the week before.
It might have been a week and a half. I think it was about a week and a half ago. The podcast about podcasts thing, like, I don't remember exactly where that came from. But like looking at the words on the show doc, I'm like, yeah, that, like, because do you remember Web Snark?
Vaguely.
Yeah. So there was basically, he was a guy who did critique of web comics, right? So he would basically round up the web comics and go, here's why this one is good. And it was almost like a literary critique of web comics, which is something that the genre kind of needed at the outset, right? You needed somebody to sort of vet things for you. Because there was thousands of them, and about 99% of them were absolute garbage, and 1% of them were, you know, diamonds, and most of those are still going. And I was thinking, like, podcasts right now are exploding. There's like thousands and millions of them, right? Like everyone and their brother has a podcast.
Yeah, literally more podcasts than people at this point.
Yeah, so there's 8 billion and one podcast.
Hey, wait till, like, this is the one space that AI hasn't truly taken over yet. So give it another week and a half and there will literally be more podcasts than people.
Well, yeah. And they'll just be podcasting to each other. It's AI podcasts for AI people. But I was thinking that, like, it makes sense to kind of have here's a sort of in-depth analysis of this podcast and what it's about and who the people are and why it's significant or insignificant or why you shouldn't listen to it. I don't know. It's probably more work than it's worth. So if somebody else wants to take that and run, like, go for it, because I'm never going to do it.
Okay. So you are a podcast critiquer and you've listened to a random sampling of Nerding Under the Influence for the first time. What would you have to say about this podcast?
I would have to say that these are definitely not audio nerds. it's boring, right? Our podcast is absolutely, and I like that. That's one of the things that I actually enjoy about it, because the world is very exciting right now. We need boring. Boring is good. Mm-hmm. I like boring. It's very obvious that we're doing this, like, for ourselves. Yes. Right. We don't have an audience. Like, if you're listening to this, that's great. I, you know, thank you. We love you. Send us an email. But, like, if everyone was to go away and stop listening to this podcast forever, we wouldn't stop. Right. And that's very obvious in our presentation. Mm-hmm. You know, as much quality as you would inject into this podcast in the edit, it's obvious that we don't know what the fuck we're doing.
Oh, yeah. No.
So I mean, like, it would almost be like I might listen to the first. You know what? Here's the thing. I'll go back to Rich's comment after, you know, having a conversation with him where I asked him, like, hey, can you subscribe to the YouTube channel? Because it'll really help us sort of get the ball rolling. It's like, yeah, I'll give you a subscribe and maybe I'll listen to, holy fuck, these things are 2.5 hours long. Right. And I think that that's probably the very first thing that anyone knew to our podcast is going to, it's like, this is 2.5 hours of literally nothing. Like this is Seinfeld, the podcast, only without the jokes. It's about nothing.
Well, I don't know whether I should feel offended or proud that we can record, you know, 2.5 hours of something about nothing semi-consistently. Here we are, episode 48.
Mm-hmm.
And we've added absolutely nothing of value.
No. Oh, God, no. This is not a value-added podcast. This is 100% overhead. This is the noise upon which the signal of the internet rides.
Well, podcasts are weird too, right? Like, yes. The definition of what is a podcast has changed and is so varied from, you know, where it started. The idea that this was kind of a semi-independent alternative to things like radio and talk TV and stuff like that for people like you and I mean, we kind of fit into what would have been the original podcast, right, back in the day.
Yeah.
And now that the medium has taken off, I mean, the people from what would be traditional media have, I don't want to say invaded the space, because, you know, that would be taking a sort of a defensive position, and I don't feel that way about it. But they've moved into the space, recognizing its potential. Recognize, I mean, there's a lot of benefits to it too, right? Production costs, stuff like that, the cost of distribution versus actually running something on the radio. In some cases, they're just reusing content that had been recorded for other media and stuff too. I get it. We live in a world where so many people want to consume things at their own pace, in their own schedule. It totally makes sense. But now you have what you and I do, and then you have, you know, like these, Tanya listens to a lot of what I would call more mainstream podcasts. And again, I don't mean it negatively, but, you know, you get big celebrities that are doing their own podcasts,
mm-hmm.
have their own podcast networks where they're pulling in other celebrities to do it, or what used to be the popular genre of like true crime podcasts. Now you have like Dateline just running their own stuff in podcast format. And you're using the same word to describe those and what we do. And that just seems wrong. I don't know if we need another word now, but
I don't think so. I think what you're going to find is that what we're doing will eventually just die.
I don't think so.
What? Hang on. I have a sort of an analogy to throw out there. Do you remember cable access TV? Mm-hmm. Does it still exist? It doesn't, right? And the thing that's like, that's kind of what we're doing, is it? And I've seen it happen on YouTube as well. Like what YouTube, I remember when YouTube was, what was it, like a 60 second limit? YouTube used to be TikTok basically, only without the viewership.
Yeah. I mean, you could upload, I think initially 10 or 15 minutes or something like that, but there was time limits, you know.
It was very short. I remember like the original was very short until Google bought them, and then it became much more. But it used to be like, especially if you go back and look at, like, if you try and find the oldest videos on YouTube, you'll find that the quality of everything was just awful, because people were, it was like camcorder shit, right?
Sure.
It was lower production quality than cable access TV. It was just, hey, I filmed this in my backyard.
Sure.
Here you go. Look at it, right? Like, hey, I made a film of my dog. And you look at what's coming out on YouTube now, and it's basically like TV production quality, and the budgets are in the millions of dollars. Mm-hmm. And I think the same thing is sort of happening with, and I think it's a natural evolution for all kinds of media where, you know, sort of the nerdy enthusiasts start and it becomes popular, and then money moves in and production quality goes up. And it's not so much that the barrier of entry changes, it's that the barrier of like getting notice gets higher.
Sure. And I agree with you to a certain extent. I think the key difference is in traditional media formats, you're not just competing for your listeners' time, you're competing with the platform time, right? It's only so many slots that a television channel can air. There's so many, you know, only so many hours a day that a single radio station can broadcast, that kind of thing. So while you do see, like with YouTube, these big channels blow up and the production values go up, and now you've got YouTube channels that have teams of, you know, 20, 30, 100 people producing content for their stuff, the small people still can find their niche. It's more difficult. There's certainly no arguing that. And as algorithmic discovery has sort of become the big thing, it's harder and harder to do that. But people can find a small audience, you know, a niche audience in a lot of cases, mm-hmm. and hold on and retain that audience and not have to compete directly with the big guys in the same way you used to have to, you know, like there's only so many hours a day a person can listen to podcasts.
Yes, that's the limit.
Right. But it's a medium where I think part of the reason people originally started listening to podcasts is because they didn't want mainstream. They wanted something that was a little bit different. And I don't think that those people, like their tastes haven't changed so much that they're now just embracing what used to be on TV or what used to be on the radio. The stuff that they sort of shunned initially, they intentionally still seek out stuff that aligns with the reasons that they were listening to podcasts to begin with, right? So I think there's always going to be room for the small people to find the small audience. Now, those small people should not ever expect exponential growth and sort of that viral aligning of the stars that could happen in the past, right? Where it's all of a sudden your large audience becomes a very, very large audience. But if you have the talent, you've got the drive, you want to put in the work. I mean, look, we're doing it. It's not that difficult to do. If we can figure this shit out, somebody that actually has talent and charisma and skills can do this too.
I don't disagree that the barrier of entry is still very low. I mean, I don't know how much money you've spent on audio equipment, but I basically stole a microphone from you. That's my investment. But my objection is to the word always. And I don't think that it's going to be the sort of swift turnaround that we're expecting to see in a lot of places. I think that what's going to happen, and it's a long-term thing, because cable access news and cable access sort of homegrown TV was a thing for like 25 or 30 years, right? Podcasts really started taking off in the last 10 years. I would expect the kind of stuff that we're doing to be around until, oh, I don't know, 2050 or so, 2060. Like, I'm not saying that, oh, you know, the big corporations are going to come in and take over the podcast. What I think will happen is that over time, new people coming into, oh, I'm going to listen to podcasts, aren't going to be directed to us. Even if we would be the niche that they're looking for, they're going to be directed to, oh, these are the ones that I have heard about and that my friends are listening to, mm-hmm. right? So what happens sort of over time is that the big budget sort of really entertaining stuff just takes more and more viewership. And we end up with, you know, like there's only so many hours in the day that you can listen to a podcast. I don't know about you, but 2.5 hours is about my limit. And then I'm like, I don't want to listen to someone else talk anymore. So eventually, like that sort of like the average person's day will be taken up with 2.5 hours of that podcast. And there will just be less room for people doing what we're doing. And people will see, well, it's less popular for that to happen, so I'm not going to start. And there will be some new medium that will come out and they will jump onto that, whatever that is.
Maybe.
I mean, it's the future. Nobody really knows.
Yeah, we've only got to live for, you know, 30 years more to find out, I guess. I don't know. I think of podcasting almost more like live streaming, not in like format, but in sort of the personal relationship that people tend to feel like they have with the content creator versus even like the higher end YouTube channels and stuff like that, right? Like if you'd have told me 30 years ago, you know, you're going to get to a time where like a significant percentage of our population, what they do for entertainment is watch other people play video games and talk. And I mean, okay, maybe that'll be a thing for a little while, but that's got to wear out, right? Like, how long can a person spend watching other people play video games?
There are some people that I could probably watch play video games for a long time, just because they're entertaining people. But they're people that I would watch them knit if they were talking. Like, I don't care what they're doing. Like, that's not the important part.
That's the point that I'm trying to make, yeah, is that, you know, how it's panned out has proven that, like, not only will, you know, a person watch a person play video games for a long time, but hundreds of thousands of people will watch somebody real time on their own schedule play video games and talk and shoot the shit and have that sort of, it's like, I don't know, going and seeing a local band versus like buying CDs or vinyl that comes, you know, from a studio and production house and stuff like that, where it's like, no, I know that guy's name. Like, I've shared the same air as that person, right?
Ah, funny story about that. Co-Carnage was actually in our EverQuest guild for a hot minute.
Yeah?
Yeah, the second time that we went back to play TLPs, he just, somebody who was in the guild sort of knew somebody who knew somebody who knew him. And they're like, hey, we're doing this thing on the TLP. Do you want to join it and maybe stream it and maybe it'll be entertaining? And I think that he was with us for 3 weeks, and there was a combination of like EverQuest is just not inherently entertaining, and he can't actually stream our guild chatter because it's just too foul. Yeah. But he was a fun guy.
Yeah. I mean, we've proven that people will watch or listen to almost anything. You know, yes, there's people, it's huge in Japan, and I get it. You know, there's some social reasons before it, but we're social creatures. And yes, we all have a social quotient that a lot of us don't do a good job of fulfilling. So there's streamers like that. The whole thing that they do is they will prepare a meal and live stream eating and talking to an audience that is eating with them. Like, they're like having dinner the way people would normally sit around a table with each other. But it's not that. Like, it's
a substitute, though.
It's a substitute, but it's also, I guess, just illustrative of how this type of media feels more personal, I guess. Like, the kind of media that allows for that feels more personal than tuning into, you know, ABC Channel 6, blah, 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 you know, for reruns of Night Court at 11:30.
I would absolutely turn in for reruns of Night Court anytime, anywhere.
Night Court was a great show.
It was an awesome show. Speaking of personal things, there's one young lady who does a sort, it's a cooking channel, but it's like a Hungry Fans thing. I see her shorts show up on YouTube from time to time, which her sort of opening line is, I hope you're hungry, babe. I mean, she's an attractive young woman, and she cooks things, and it's like, I don't know what the recipe is, but she's cracking sort of off-color jokes the whole time, mm-hmm, right? And it's one of those things that, like, okay, if I were to try and do that, it would not go over because I'm just not fun to look at, right? But she's got an undeniable talent for scripting that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And it's like, you know, the first time you tune in, you're like, oh, you're a hot chick. And then it's like, oh, this is really witty. What's the next one? Like, oh, here comes a joke. It's a good one, right?
Yeah.
So there is a lot of room for people to do that sort of, here is a new idea for presenting something. I'm not suggesting that, like, we're going to disappear overnight. There's a lot of room for raw talent to show up here that wouldn't make it in traditional channels. I'm like looking at it from the 40,000 foot view, like, I can see that it has the same sort of arc that pretty much every media has gone through, right? Sure. Poetry was absolutely huge, and then eventually it was only a few big poets, and then it died, you know. And then the radio show was like, it was everything, and then it just sort of petered out, right? And TV did the same thing, and YouTube is sort of in the beginning part of that arc, and then sort of podcasting, I think, is going to follow the same arc, and just it's slower, and we're still at the very, very beginning of that. It's a theory.
Well, before the inevitable heat death of the podcast universe, let's talk about some people that we would like to either have on a podcast, see as a guest on a podcast, do a podcast of their own. You mentioned Bruce Campbell, and this is a throwback to the very first episode of our show, where we were discussing how we could go back to the Firefly universe, like with a new show.
Oh, yeah.
And we said, you know what? Like, we need Bruce Campbell as captain of a ship, sort of leading a ensemble cast for something in Firefly.
Yeah. He would be, he'd be fantastic at almost everything. I've been rewatching Burn Notice. Have you ever watched it?
Yes.
Yeah. I forget what the fella's name is who's the star. It's not really important. He hasn't really done anything in a starring role other than that. I don't think he showed up as sort of like a co-star elsewhere, but Bruce Campbell is sort of his semi-sidekick in that. And he's just, he plays an ex-Navy SEAL, right? And you can tell that his knees don't work anymore, right? And he's got a bad back, and he's like, he's destroyed his body from his young acting career. Because I think he was probably in his late 40s or maybe even 50s when he started that show. Mm-hmm. But he's absolutely not, like, physically, he's not convincing, but he's just the ideal character, right? He's a little bit boozy. He's charming. He's a little bit of a ladies man. And it's just like this role was, if they had cast anyone else in this role, this show would have tanked. Mm-hmm. But he's fun. And I saw him on one of those, Vanity Fair, whoever it is, where they do so-and-so answers the internet's most asked questions, or can so-and-so remember their iconic lines from where they're from and whatever. And he was just like, off the cuff telling stories about his experiences on movies. And I'm like, I just want to listen to this guy talk about his life for hours.
Yeah. And I suppose we should caveat this discussion by saying, since there's more podcasts than people, there's a good chance most of these people have podcasts already and we just don't know about it yet.
Well, I know the second person on my list does have a podcast.
Okay.
So I don't know if you watch anything BBC, you know who Victoria Coren Mitchell is. She was Victoria Coren. She was a famous poker player for a bit. And then she...
Okay, that's where I recognize the name from then.
Yeah. She's very, very smart. And also, it's funny, right? Because her husband is... I've forgotten his first name. He does the rants. He goes off on a rant and does stuff. I'm sorry, my brain is full of olives that are soaked in gin, so I'm forgetting people's names. David Mitchell is his name, and he's a comedian, right? Like, that's how he got his start, and he's on a lot of panel shows and stuff. He's on Would I Lie to You on the BBC, and he's very overtly funny. And Victoria comes off as a very sort of, not monotone, but you know what I mean? Like, she's kind of that, I'm a proper person and I speak with good diction and I have excellent vocabulary and I'm very bright and I'm very smart and everything that I say is very straight. And then she will let go with a zinger with a completely straight face and you don't catch it until a couple of words after the joke has been made. And it's just like, her wit is just And I know that she either has a podcast or co-stars in a podcast or is a frequent guest on someone else's podcast, because she's mentioned it on a couple of her shows. I don't think that we'll ever have the viewership to have her as a guest.
No, no, no. We're still trying to get Ian as a guest. We know him. We have a close personal relationship with that guy.
Yeah. Well, yeah. But I mean, like, he's a busy guy and he's important, right?
Yeah. And we're not.
No, we're not. Maybe if we offer him free beer.
Hey, Ian. Free beer? Just saying. Yeah. No, he legitimately, he brought it up a couple weeks ago. He's like, I'm going to get on there. We're going to do like an in-person pod bag episode. We just haven't had time to put it together yet. He's, we know that he recently got married. He's enjoying the... honeymoon period, we'll say. Mm-hmm. And nobody who listens to this show really knows who Ian is, so I'm probably not crossing any lines here by letting it slip, but he and his wife are expecting.
Oh, well, congratulations, Ian and Mrs. Ian.
Yeah, so, I mean, I suspect that we might have to wait a decade or so before he finds time to actually guest on our podcast, but it'll happen someday.
Well, we might have Ian Jr. before we actually get Ian.
Ooh, now you're thinking.
That's why I'm CEO of this podcast.
Are you?
Oh. I don't.
Are you my boss?
I'm your boss and you're my boss, and that's how that works.
All right.
Communism, baby.
All right. Well, we've talked about podcasts for an hour. Let's talk about video games or something.
Okay.
I used to be an adventurer like you.
Stay a while and listen.
Speaking of vaporware, I've been following Pantheon Rise of the Fallen since, 2016? 2014? It's been near 10 years.
Like Star Citizen EverQuest Edition, right? Like,
even more so. Like, yeah. It was, because it was Brad, what's the guy who was responsible for EverQuest mostly? It's not important. But he was sort of the driving force behind getting EverQuest actually published. And then they basically kicked him out. There's a whole drama. You can look it up. I don't know the details.
The guy that was the composer, Chris Perkins, is basically running the show there now, isn't he? Not the Chris Perkins from Works for Wizards of the Coast. Different guy. But I think that's his name.
Maybe. I haven't paid attention. Somebody sent me a link and basically said, hey, it's actually in early access and you can buy the thing and play the game now. And I was like, oh my God. And it's surprisingly good for early access in an MMO. There's lots of stuff that doesn't work. The graphics aren't 100% in. The balance is not there.
They just, before opening up early access, revamped all of the graphics. Did you see what they were like beforehand?
No, I didn't. I saw something because CoCarnage did something like 5 or 6 years ago, and it looks pretty good. And I was like, okay, this is fine. This looks acceptable. And it's not bad. Like, they've gone for sort of a little bit more stylized thing. But the thing is that when you're releasing a game, the sort of skins and graphics are the last thing you do. So, or almost the last thing you do. So I'm not really worried about it. It doesn't look bad. Like, I don't want to give because the environments are pretty good.
The character art and stuff probably isn't changing. Like, this new revamp of it is probably what you're getting. And it does look like a game from 2003, but it's appealing to people who want to play a video game like it's 2003 too, right?
It's worth noting that at the same time, I have also been playing Horizon Zero Dawn Remastered. And in that game, the updated graphics, because it's basically Horizon Forbidden West with like a mod that makes it Zero Dawn, that the graphics change there made a huge difference to my enjoyment in the game. Mm-hmm. But that one is very character focused, right? So someone's face, not like Aloy doesn't have eyebrows, even at like ultra settings in the original Zero Dawn. And in Forbidden West, she looks like a person, right? Like, it comes out of the uncanny valley into, okay, this is obviously animation and it's good. But it's, you don't need that kind of graphics for something like an MMO. You just
No. And I, you know, as a guy who enjoys WoW, even in its sort of original form, it was hard to go backwards from that to trying to jump into EverQuest again, like even, you know, post EQ99 stuff. When I dabbled with it there for a little while, it's like, oh, this is painful. Looking at Pantheon, it represents a lot of the things that I don't like in MMOs. I'm willing to maybe give it a look at some point here. I have questions.
Well, ask.
No. I mean, there's some things that'll just sort of need to be proven out. I'm not informed, like how difficulty works. I don't like, you know, because it's not instanced, right? My understanding is that they were talking about doing maybe some phasing type stuff, but it's not instanced for things like dungeon raid type stuff. And there isn't limitations on group size and stuff when it comes to that. One of the things that I don't like is MMOs where the difficulty problem is solved by bring more people. That isn't sort of a challenge check for me. It's not a challenge thing that I'm overly interested in. So I'm interested to see how in this game that plays out. Part of my problem is that, you know, I just don't like playing with people anymore. Maybe MMOs are just something that I should give up on.
Yeah, kind of. I mean, that's the whole point of an MMO, right in the name. Play with other people. Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, having said that, I'm currently level 7 on my 7th alt. And up to level 7, you know, soloing is perfectly fine. You're not doing a whole lot. You're killing rats, yeah, right, up to level 7. But there's like, it scratches the itch for me of EQ. And it really reminds me of sort of a high poly count early WoW.
Yeah. Well, I mean, part of the thing that might be interesting about it, again, it's like one of those games, and there's been a few where there's no map. Right. This is back before you had quest indicators or add-ons that gave you quest indicators that just pointed you where to go. You got a loose description about, hey, I need something from these trees or something like that. And you had to go find those trees. Even if it was a simple fetch quest, it wasn't like, hey, I need XYZ and it's right over there.
Yeah. It's very much an ask your friends kind of thing. Now, there is an offline map that someone has made that has, you know, sort of. And that's going to happen. There's a couple of really neat innovations that I quite like. First of all, you can climb stuff, right? Like when you come to a vertical wall, you can climb up it, which is, but you have a certain amount of endurance or whatever you want to call it. And if you run out and you're not all the way up, you fall down to the bottom again, which is neat. At night, things get really dark. And this I didn't realize, but after it gets dark, you can't see the name tags of mobs anymore unless you have a torch, in which case you can see their name tags now, which is, it's just like, there's just some neat stuff.
It's neat. It's interesting, but like, you have to strike the right balance. And I guess for me, it's like, will this game do that? You know?
Nope.
So if it's dark, is the solution find a way to be able to play this game in the dark? Or is the solution do nothing until it's light again? Because one of those could be fun and the other one probably isn't.
You have to adjust. My experience is like I've died a few times in the dark. Mm-hmm. My experience is that you have to adjust the difficulty of the mobs you are going to target down in the dark. Because you have one of two choices. You put a torch in your offhand, in which case you're either missing a shield or an extra weapon, which means your AC or your damage goes down. Or you fight in the dark, in which case you might get jumped. You could die.
Do they have mechanics in place for like increasing mob aggression and stuff like that at night? Either making them more challenging, more of them, or if you're going to pull out a torch, more attracted to you?
Not so far. The mobs do change. Skeletons mostly only come out at night. Mm-hmm. There is a certain mob type called a Grimling, which only comes out at night, which I discovered as I was running back to town. Because what I've been doing, the day-night cycle is a little bit weird. Like the day cycle, I think, is a little over an hour long. And then the night cycle is like 20 minutes long.
Okay.
So even if you were going to, because what I've been doing is because like I've been doing crafting, right? Because I'm soloing, so I'm not killing named mobs to get good drops. Mm-hmm. So I'm like farming ore and leather skins and stuff. And what I do is I go out and do that during the day, get some experience. And then when night comes, I go back to town and do my crafting. And the crafting is difficult enough. Like, it's not really difficult. You buy the pattern, you gather the stuff, you push the button, and it crafts it.
This game is very much in the EverQuest vein or, like, early vanilla WoW, where even the act of, like, leveling at level 1 is really something they're encouraging you to do in a group, right? Like, you can do it solo, but...
It's not so much level 1, but by level 5, they're expecting you to start. Because the mobs start thinning out and giving, like the mobs that you can kill solo start giving less and less experience.
Okay.
But there's lots of stuff, and it's not very crowded right now, obviously, because it's early access. There's a few things that I can foresee as problems. Crowding is going to be one of them. And if there's no instance content, then there's going to be a lot of people. This is one of the problems with early EverQuest when nothing was instanced, is that, you know, people are on the bat phone. So every 7 days, you know, named mob 01 spawns and it immediately dies to the 300 people who do not have a job and are able to do that.
Yeah.
So you end up with like 72 people who have the very best gear on the server and are denying it to everyone else on the server. And the problem with that is not so much that they have it and other people don't. It's that the people who don't are going to stop playing. And then you don't have enough people to keep your game viable.
Yeah.
You have to have something for them to do, right? So I can foresee that being a problem if there isn't a mechanism for, you know, like you need something for everyone else to do, not just the top, you know, 1% of players.
The other thing about it that immediately made me wrinkle my nose a little bit was the limited action bar stuff, the sort of Guild Wars 2 style. You can have all sorts of abilities, but you can only pull X number of them out and use them at any one point in time.
See, I prefer that.
There's lots of people that play, you know, MOBA games, which to me, that's kind of what they were, was just like dumbed down MMOs where you've got four buttons to push or something like that. This is a little bit more than that, not quite that extreme, but.
No, there's three different types of abilities. There's techniques and skills and abilities. I think I forget exactly what they're called, but you have your sort of zero to or one to equal sign for spells and whatnot. And then you have four potential techniques that you can have at any one time. And you can have more hotbars than that as well. So I think that there's a certain amount of limits, and that makes sense to me. Right. Because I mean, I used to run into people in WoW who are like, I have 721 keybinds. I can have all of my skills out at any one time. It's like, well, yeah. Right. And like, I sort of get the appeal of that too, but that does not appeal to me. I don't want to have to memorize shit. I have to do that at work all day. This is a game. I want it to be simple.
See, and that's the meta that I enjoyed, right? Like, I loved, you know, I played a Holy Paladin through a lot of Burning Crusade healing raids, and not only did I have X number of spells out of my bars, but I had several different ranks of each spell so that I could like tune my mana efficiency during raid content so that I could downrank spells to sort of break even on mana and then only really expend mana faster than I was regenning it when I needed to pop some big heals. And once they did away with having the downranked spells, like even WoW got a little, even though I still had bars all over the place bound to my Logitech G13 and my MMO gaming mouse and, you know, modifiers and all of that shit. Even that dumbed it down a little bit. No, dumbed down isn't the right word. It streamlined it a little bit too much and took away some of that meta that I enjoyed. I'm not most people, right? Like, I'm sure most people prefer the simplified thing. Their strategy, their enjoyment doesn't come from gaming the system. It comes from gaming the game. So I'm the one that's a little fucked up.
It's just a different way of appreciating things. And I was thinking about this, and specifically about the crafting sort of mechanic. So in order, for example, to build or to make yourself a leather belt, right, you have to farm animal skins. You have to turn the animal skins into tattered leather. You have to turn the tattered leather into something else. You have to turn that into straps. And then you also need tattered leather and thread. So you have to do like a whole bunch of things. And you don't really know what it is that you need until you get to the point of the other thing. And then you have to backtrack. So there's a lot of wasted time unless you've made yourself a spreadsheet ahead of time. And I got to thinking about like, why do I enjoy this? And for me, it's the chaos of I need to sort out what I need to do. Right. And you talk about sort of the strategy of how do you make things more efficient during raid time. That's the thing about EverQuest that I enjoyed is all of that planning happened before you started. Mm-hmm. After you started, it's implement the plan, right? It was really, EverQuest was really, really hard to adjust on the fly. Like if you didn't bring enough DPS, you couldn't correct for that. If you didn't bring enough healing, you couldn't correct for that. If you got your CC wrong, you couldn't correct for that. you had to learn from it and try it again. It was very much like Pac-Man or Mario Brothers, right? You get three lives and then you get to start again from the beginning.
Yeah.
And as much as I hate that, for some reason, I really enjoy it in an MMO where it's like, I've died a bunch of times where it's like, I can handle this. Oh shit, I can't handle that. And it's like, all right, well, now I got to. The one thing I don't enjoy about Pantheon, and I think that they've struck a reasonable balance, is the corpse retrieval thing, right? When you die, you lose a little bit of experience. You have to go back and get your stuff, but you don't lose anything that's equipped. So you still have your weapons. You still have your armor. You drop all of your bags and all of the stuff that was in them and all of your money.
Okay.
And then you got to go back and get it. And if you want your experience back, you got to find somebody to resurrect you. Which in a group setting is usually fine, right? Like mm-hmm. you'll usually have somebody in the group. But so far I haven't done any grouping, so I can't comment on that. But I've been enjoying sort of the kind of grind that it is.
So one of the things that I would assume about a game like that is that it isn't just the style of mechanics that appeal to you, but also that style and mechanics probably turns away a certain type of player that you would prefer not to play with anyway. Like it's a filter.
It is a bit. It is a bit.
Have you found that in your limited experience playing the game that the people that you're, I know you probably haven't interacted with a ton of people, but it feels less, how can I put this delicately?
It's definitely not the Call of Duty lobby. No.
Yeah.
Those players are still there. They're always going to be, right? They're people who want to excel at everything. I've had an awful lot of conversations with people in out of character, right? Like I'm talking to the whole server at that point. There's like, I don't know, 50 or 60 people logged in.
Yeah.
And people have been largely helpful, right? Even through the sarcastic responses, which are like huge, right? Like, how do you heal magic? Right. Or like, where's the map? Like there is no map. There is some discussion about a map. And like in my mind, I'm okay with not having a map that shows where I am and where everything is relative to me. But I would really like to have a map that shows the general area that I'm in and like where the towns and cities are. Uh-huh. Right. Like imagine you have a paper map, like you unfold a paper map and go, okay, well, I think I'm about there. Okay, so the city's probably north of me from here. That's what the kind of thing that I'm looking for.
Yeah.
Having no map is kind of annoying. And they're still going back and forth on that, so I don't know where they're going to end up.
Yeah, I know that there's a demand for games that, like, I was looking at some of the feedback and looking at some forums about the game and a lot of criticism. You see some YouTube videos of people that weren't of that time making comments sort of through the lens of being a person who enjoys what would be a more modern MMO. And the YouTube comments are just filled with, you know, a lot of things with like, that's the point. It's not that, you know, not having a map is bad. Like, that's the point. We come from a time when you had to draw your own map and that's part of what we're looking for and stuff like that. And I get that to a certain extent. One of the things that I found with other projects that have sort of try to recreate something from the past like that is that it sort of attracted like real elitist schmucks to put it delicately. Like in my job as a developer, right? Like we have tools, sites that we routinely would look at when we're trying to troubleshoot, problem solve, or whatever. You go to like Stack Overflow or something, right? And almost the worst possible thing you could ever do there is actually post a question.
Yes.
You'll ask something like, how do I do this? And, you know, you get 19 answers. It's like, well, you don't. Or why would you ever want to do that? Like, look.
Yeah.
Yada, yada, yada. I get it. Maybe this isn't the best way to do this particular thing. But in the context of the limits that I'm operating within, I need to do this. How do I do this? You don't. Get good, scrub. You know, like, it's not the 12-year-old kids teabagging you that are pissing you off. It's the, you know, 40-year-old elitist schmucks that are, I don't know.
It's a tribal thing. It really is. I mean, it's evidenced in every part of our society. But yes,
yeah,
that does exist to an extent. But it's it, like people who are attracted, speaking specifically of this game, people who are attracted to this game are people who largely know what they're in for, right? When someone asks, is there a map? It's because, like, is there a map? And when the answer is no, it's like, okay, I'm not going to quit. I'm not going to say that that's wrong. Mm-hmm. I mean, I have made the comment that I would love to have like the equivalent of a paper map that I don't have to alt tab out to look at.
Yeah.
Right. Just a paper map. It doesn't show where I am or where anyone is. It shows the town I'm in and the sort of surrounding county. Mm-hmm. So I have a general idea. Cause the thing is like, if you grew up in the town, you're going to have an idea of where shit is.
Yeah.
Right. That kind of information is like, hey, over here's the newbie area. Over here's the Shaman's Guild, right? Like, you know how games used to come with a manual, and in the manual, there would be some sort of guidance about how to get started? Mm-hmm. I'd like that level of instruction, right? And I think that would be helpful, especially for bringing in, you're not going to get new players, but you're going to get players who are new to this game. And it would be nice to sort of, anyway, I mean, I go off on a tangent. I digress. I like the game. I'm enjoying it. It's not for everyone, right? It was designed as a niche game. It is a niche game. It is going to have a niche audience.
Well, I haven't had a ton of time for games the past couple of weeks. Some of it's for obvious reasons. Mm-hmm. I've been doing a little bit more Satisfactory. I think my playthrough is at like 130, 135 hours now. And I'm at the point where if I want to continue playing, it's like, get ready to set aside another 200 hours. And that's not a negative thing. I'm just questioning whether I'm ready for that right now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as you progress through tiers, like, you know, I've talked it before, like it's not just a game of building factories, but it's a game of building factories, tearing them down, building better factories, tearing those down, building better factories as you progress through different technology tiers. And I've now like I've unlocked the what would be the final tier, so this is content that didn't exist in early access, and there's this sort of balance to be struck between like I could build small factories and just leave the game logged in for 3 weeks at 4 weeks and maybe manufacture enough to get through basically finish the game, right? Mm-hmm. And I mean, that kind of defeats the purpose of the game. So it's like, okay, now you need to think about factories on a completely different scale. You need to think about harvesting resources and efficiency at a completely different scale. And I'm excited by the idea, but it's like, okay, I've spent 130 hours playing the game so I could get to the point where I can spend another 200 hours playing the game. And I don't think I'm ready to dive into that. Maybe that'll be an over the holidays thing. I tend to get a little bit of time off between Christmas and New Year's. And yeah, maybe I'll put some time into that there. I have ideas for what I want to do. But right now I just, you know, I log in and it's like, do you want to start doing the stuff that you know you need to do? Nope. And I turn it off. Not because I'm not enjoying it.
That's kind of the mark of a good game, though, is that like you're looking at the long term and thinking, I should set aside the time to do this right.
Yeah. The other game that I kind of want to dig into is the new Dragon Age is out, the Veil Guard. It was going to be called Dreadwolf for a while, but I've been a big fan of the Dragon Age series. Dragon Age Origins, I've talked about before, very much in my... If it's not in my top 10 list, it's pretty close. As somebody who enjoyed Baldur's Gate 3, I mean, Dragon Age is going to feel a little bit dated, but I definitely encourage you to go back in and play it. Dragon Age 2 disappointed most people. I really enjoyed it myself. It got a little bit more action RPG rather than just RPG, and each successive game has sort of moved it along that spectrum a little bit more. I didn't hate Dragon Age Inquisition, but it didn't land with me at all. And I think this this new game, I kind of expect to feel the same way about it. But what am I going to do, like not play it? For somebody who's loved this series, been invested in it, played through three, you know, pretty big ass games in the series, over a span of, I don't know, 15 years. I don't know when the first one came out now. I'm not going to not play it.
Well, I guess you got to.
But it would be like jumping into a Horizon game at this point, right? Where it's like, okay, you're going to need to put 80 hours into this if you want to experience it. I don't know if I got it in me right now.
If only it was like your job or something.
Right? I should become one of those streamers that four people watch play video games for a living. I'm sure that's sustainable for me.
Well, you only need like one of them to be super rich and just send you money for feet pics and you'll be fine.
Okay. Well, hey, if you want to solicit my feet pics, if you want to be my sugar daddy, sugar mama, I mean, I'm not picky here. Send us an email. Podbag@nerding under the influence. Just like use the subline, like give feet pics and I'll know what the message is about. If you want to sponsor my bad habits and allow me to play video games instead of working for a living, listen, I'm not interested.
There you go. You heard it here first, folks.
Goodbye, Gravity. Not bad.
Good beer.
I mean, I enjoyed it, and that's saying a lot as somebody who isn't generally a beer enjoyer. Let's see how this Chalky Walky does. Ooh. It's strong. I can smell just how strong it is.
Uh-oh. For those of you listening at home, Shane's pants have just fallen off.
That's like the seventh time that joke's come up while we've been recording.
I mean, it keeps happening.
It's a good joke. Don't get me wrong. Maybe we need a new one, but
yeah,
if it ain't broke.
Yeah, jokes don't need to be funny.
I'm on the fence about this one.
Oh, okay. I'm sure that you'll like it by the time you get to the bottom of it.
Well, I guess this is an interesting sort of thing about beer, right? Like if you're marketing it as a beer that has flavor. So it is a chocolate milkshake stout.
It doesn't taste like chocolate, does it?
I don't want it to taste like a mudslide, right? Like I don't want that.
Mm-hmm.
But you expect at least a discernible sort of bouquet of chocolate adjacent something.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure that I'm getting that.
Yeah. I found there's been a few times I've tried beers that have been sort of marketed as chocolate ideas. And chocolate has never been something that I've gotten out of it.
Yeah. And like, not just chocolate milkshake, you know?
Yeah, that's a bizarre thing to label a beer. I mean, cocoa has been used in a lot of different ways. Like originally, as far as I know, cocoa was actually paired with like spicy peppers.
Yeah.
And it is really, really good to add. Like if you have something spicy, like you add cocoa to it, it enhances it. It's nice.
That is the secret ingredient in my chili.
Yeah.
Yeah. I like 95% Belgian chocolate.
Yep.
Not a lot. You know, if I'm making a big pot, let's say, I don't know what the size, like not quite stock pot size, but like a big normal person's pot size of chili, I put right at the end, like after I turn the heat off, I will put in about half a bar, 95% chocolate, and just stir it in and then let the chili rest for a little bit. You don't want to put the chocolate in because it'll almost taste like it's burning if you put it in while you're actively cooking it. But if you just, as soon as you turn the heat off, mix it in, gives it a, like a creaminess almost.
Yep.
And that's missing from this beer.
Yeah. Chocolate and beer, not necessarily a good pairing. I mean, eat some Milk Duds and drink a Coors.
Hey, do you want to talk about books?
Let's talk about books.
A book?
That's right. When I was your age, television was called books. And this is a special book.
As you wish. So I started reading the second book in the Expanse series. And the style, it's funny because I started watching the TV show a bit ago. I think I got, I don't know, 5 minutes in or so before I had to stop and do something else. And I recognized the opening of this book as the opening of that series. So I'm not sure how much of the first book made it into the series, but the style of the two books is very different. Like I mentioned when I talked about the first one, that it reminded me a lot of like Ray Bradbury and Robert Heinlein. And
yeah. Now you'd just gotten into it, so you really haven't spoken much about the first one. So maybe reiterate some of that. Yeah.
Okay. Well, yeah, it very much reminded me of a lot of the pulp from the 50s and 60s in a good way. Mm-hmm. It had a lot of like hard technical details that were really well sort of melded into the story. It did not feel like if you've ever read the sort of pulp mercenary books like Mac Bolan and those kind of things, where it's like, let me describe to you. Oh, and who's the Hunt for Red October guy? Tom Clancy. He does a lot of things where, you know, like he'll be describing things and then he'll tell you like the exact model number of the gun and like the seven guns that this crew is carrying or whatever. And those are technical details that his audience really likes, but they always feel a little bit superfluous to the story. Whereas the technical details here really feel like part of the story. I don't want to go into the plot too much, because if you haven't read it, you should read it. It's good. And it takes some hard turns that are a little difficult to sort of grok in a modern storytelling tradition. Like we become accustomed to, because of the movies we watch and even books so much, it's like, here are the action beats that you're going to have. Here's how it's going to go. Here's how the arc of the story is going to go. And here's where the major crisis is. And then there's the denouement. And then there's like another crisis. And like, there's a graph that you can draw of almost every story that we tell. This one doesn't quite follow that. And it's a little bit disconcerting, which fits really well with the subject matter of the book. But I enjoyed the characters. I found a lot of sort of social commentary stuff from multiple angles that I really enjoyed. There was a very light amount of sort of politics in the first one, and it very much felt like local political stuff. One of the characters in the first book is a police detective. So you get a little bit of sort of the interdepartmental policy conflict stuff that is it feels real. It feels gritty, right? Like here's a real person who is experiencing real personal pain, problems, and growth, right? Without sort of smacking you in the face with personal history. And there's some interpersonal stuff and some conversations between people where you're like, wow, you wouldn't expect that to happen, in a story that someone's trying to tell, which is really nice. Like there was some nice surprises that didn't sort of jar you out of the story. It was very, very classic, and I liked that.
Okay. I'm going to try and avoid any spoilers here for you and for anybody listening. I've been trying to get into the first book. I've watched the show like multiple times over. I'm struggling right now. I know I said like, I don't know, 15 episodes ago, that's like, I finally made the decision I'm going to get a nice e-reader. I haven't done it yet. And I've pulled out my phone and started reading. Oh, I don't know, maybe four or five times now, even just in the past week and a half. And I end up having an argument with myself about whether I want to bother until I pick something up. I mean, realistically, I should just buy the book so that I have like a paperback or something like that. But I've been telling myself I'm going to get an e-reader and I haven't. So I have some questions about the book series as it relates to the show and based on my understanding of what is in the book series. So one of the things that I thought added a lot of flavor to the show, especially in the early seasons, was the established Belter Creole kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
My understanding is that all of that is in the books.
It's there. There's not a lot of it. Okay. I will say it's an interesting mixture of like obvious French influence, some English words that are just like sort of chopped up, some obviously new slang,
little South African in there. And it's
very, very multilingual.
There's online resources for it. Like it went, I mean, it's not as extensive as like Tolkien doing, you know, Elven in 72 mm-hmm. dialects, but there's significantly more effort put into that than there is most things in these type of books. And I'm interested to see how that, the balance that it strikes in the books, like that could get exhausting if it's just too much to get through, but.
There's not much. It's never in a place where you have to understand what they're saying. The general sense of it usually comes through, and it's almost always in a conversation where there are three people, right? There is a person who is speaking in that sort of dialect or whatever it is, someone who understands them completely and someone who doesn't understand at all. So, you know, like the person who's speaking it, it's, there's sort of a translation where it's like, this is what he said.
Okay. Because I imagine quite a fair bit of that first two books would take place on Ceres.
It's all over the place. The first one is almost feels to me like a prequel, right? It was the first one, but it feels very much like, okay, we're setting things up to happen. It's almost the kind of book that you would think, like as someone who wants to write my own stories, it's the kind of thing I would write just for me. Okay. Right. It would end up being just a set of point form notes that says, this is stuff that happens that I'm never going to describe to anybody, but I know it happened and it's going to inform stuff that happens later.
Okay. One of the things that the show really did a good job of is the developing relationship between what would be the ensemble cast and the crew, the Rocinante. Mm-hmm. Unlike something like Firefly, where episode one, they're established, they've got chemistry, they've got relationships with each other, and there's just that sort of instant, I don't know what you want to call it, that like the cast and crew of Firefly or Serenity had. They do a good job, at least in the TV series, of really making you feel like these are a bunch of people that circumstances threw together. And over the lifespan of the series, partway through it, they kind of became a family?
It depends, because in the first book, they actually take possession of the ship, right? Yeah. They you find yeah. it where they get it. There's only three of them. Or sorry, there's four of them. And then there's three mm-hmm. of them. And then there's four of them. So there's only actually three people who start off in the second book. There's Captain Holden. There's Naomi, I think her name is.
Mm-hmm. Nagata,
yeah. Who's his, like, and Amos.
Okay.
Amos. And there was another guy, Miller, but he's no longer in the picture.
Is there not the pilot character in the books?
Sorry, you're right. There is one more. Yeah, I can't remember his name either. But yes, you're right. Because there's Holden the captain, there's Naomi, who's his sort of communications weapons person. There's Amos is the mechanic, and then there's the pilot guy. So yes, you're right. There are four of them.
Okay. Yeah.
I was forgetting. He doesn't play a lot of part in the dialogue of stuff, right? He's just sort of there.
Okay. It'll be interesting to see how that develops, because in the show, like he early on, while the crew were still strangers and kind of becoming family, he was very much a glue character. It got awkward towards the end of the series, because as an actor, he was kind of wrapped up in some of the Me Too stuff that was happening, and they mm-hmm. ended up basically removing him from the show for the last season, which isn't mm. something that would have happened in the books. They wrote him out, and it wasn't great how they did it the best way they could, I guess. But I guess it makes sense that you don't get much out of him for the first book. Maybe you'll probably get more out of them for the rest.
I've only started the second book. I can say that there's an obvious sort of development of the technical skills of authoring a book between the first book and the second book.
Okay.
And the style has changed as well. There's still the same sort of technical details, but the first one reminded me a great deal of like 1950s and 60s sort of pulp fiction, science fiction. But the second book, and I'm like three or four chapters in, I think, is very much a modern style of book, right? It's not enough of a change to make you go, oh, well, these are completely different. It's just enough of a change to go, yep.
Oh, this guy's good at this now.
Yeah, he's gotten better at it, and he's changed. Well, it's a pair of people, right? It's two people.
Yeah.
And they've changed from, you know, like, ah, we're just having fun and doing this thing, and sort of as a homage to the you know, space opera stuff of the 50s and 60s to, okay, this is really a thing now, and let's write a good book. And you can see that it's because like the style of book has changed, or the style of fiction that resonates with people has changed over the last 70 years. Right. And this is very much just, we're writing a good book because this is what good books are now.
Now, one of the things that appealed to me about the series, and I'm sure this is going to be, it's a fact that it's, you know, part of the books. Getting back to the realism angle is that I haven't read or watched a lot of sci-fi that is sort of near future stuff, right? Mm-hmm. Where, like, you know, you get your Star Trek and your Star Wars, and like that's all abstracted so much from today that it's not just about technobabble. It's just about like the idea, Gene Roddenberry's utopia, right? Like here's a bunch of people that are functioning and they never have conflict with each other and blah, 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 blah. As much as I love that about like TNG especially, there's a lot of suspension of disbelief that has to happen for you to kind of separate that from this is the way the world is today. How could we ever get there? Where this show, even more so than Firefly, like Firefly did this fairly well as well, but we didn't get enough of it to really connect that world with our own. We got just little hints, but this was like a plausible, this could be us in a little while.
All that's required in order to do technically what they're doing in the book is find a way to use a nuclear reactor to create propulsion. Mm-hmm. Right. And we're not far off from that.
It isn't an optimistic future for us that it's portraying. You can sort of disconnect the story and plot a little bit from our world and just sort of consume it for what it is. But the backdrop for it is very much a humans doing what they always do kind of thing. It's not going to spoil it a lot, but you know, there's colonial overtones, corporations still suck, conflict in this case between Earth and Mars, and quasi subjugation and exploitation of other peoples, in this case the Belters, and Earth has basically been fucked at this point. You know, climate change is sort of, and I don't know how much of it they touch on in the early books, but climate change is sort of gone where we're all saying it's gonna go. You know, there's a good portion of North America, which you get into, which is literally underwater. The political machinations and power struggles and all of that shit underpins the entire story. How have you found that? Like, do you find that distracting? Do you find that interesting? Because it isn't an escape book, right? Like, it's not something that you
know.
Oh, I want to, you know, I want to shut my brain off and forget about how shitty things are. Let me go read the Expanse books.
I'm just starting to get into some of the actual political, like the direct political stuff now. Up until now, it's been kind of a backdrop where it was like in the first book, especially, it was very much just described as like Earth and Mars are kind of in cahoots, keeping the belt, like subjugated, colonized, right? There was a line actually that I was reading it in bed last night, and I stopped. I basically poked Cindy and said, listen, I have to read you this. So a war has broken out. You know, no spoilers there. You know, it's coming from like the second page of the first book. And they're the crew of the, what is, how do you pronounce it? Rocinante?
Rocinante, yeah. Or Rocinante.
So they are on a different ship and they're flying relief supplies to, I think it's Ganymede. One of the moons of Saturn anyway. And they're parked in orbit for like, I don't know, 16 hours or something while they're watching ships take off from the planet, from the moon's surface. And so they're talking, it's like the captain calls down to the tower, like landing clearance or whatever. And he's like, what's going on? Like, we've been waiting here for 16 hours. Like, what's happening? I'm really sorry, you know, blah, 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 blockade, such and such. We got to check everybody and such and whatever. We've had to launch supply ships for the last 16 hours. It's like, what do you mean? What supply ships? Like, is this people abandoning the moon? Like, are people evacuating? Like, what's happening? He's like, no, it's we move, I forget what it was, like 1.5 billion tons of food every day off planet. He's like, hang on a minute. I'm flying in relief supplies, food for your starving citizens, and you're launching 1.5 billion tons of food every day? Well, yeah, you know, like all of this food is owned by the corporations on Earth, and for every hour that they're grounded, they're losing millions of dollars. So, you know, like that food's got to go off. And I'm like, holy fuck. Like, this is just a little too real for my tastes. Like, it's literally, like, this is this is stuff that literally happens. You know, like, you've got people who are working in factories packaging food who are starving because they're not paid enough. And that's exactly what's happening still, like, several hundred years in the future. Lasai.
So, early impressions then, book one, book two, yay. People should read it.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. I would say, especially for someone just getting into it, the first few chapters of the first book are going to feel a little bit like a slog. And then it picks up from there. And book two, like, picks up from page one. Also, I will say this, you can start on book two and there will be some references that you don't understand the full import of. I think you can just pick it up from there.
So I imagine they played with the timeline a little bit in this show. Where does book one end? Like, don't need to be major spoilers.
A ship crashes into Venus. That's the end of book one.
Okay.
And the opening of book two, it starts in a kindergarten, which I think is like the very first scene of the first episode of the show. Is the young girl getting taken out of school?
No, that happens later, later season. Maybe it's a little bit circular, but, so interesting. You say a ship crashes into Venus.
I very intentionally was being vague about that.
Okay.
It's a ship like thing. Okay. Crashes into Venus.
Okay. So that lines up fairly well with the first season. So I know roughly where you are then.
Yeah. Yeah. I've just been introduced to the president of Earth, I think. President of the UN, whatever that means now. And she is significantly foul-mouthed, which I very much appreciate.
Yeah. See, they did a really good job of pulling her into the first season of the show. Ava Sarala. She's like the best character throughout the whole bloody thing. They got the perfect person to play her too. It's worth watching the show for her alone. I know her as one of the voiced characters from Mass Effect. As an actress, she played an admiral in one of the newer Star Trek movies, the J.J. Abrams ones. She's been in other things, but like, Ava Sarala is her defining character, and she's just fucking amazing.
Well, I'm a little more interested to watch the show now that I've started reading the books, because the story intrigues me. The characters are, like, I identify with all of them for one reason or another.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It's like, yeah, that was the right thing to do, but it was also the wrong thing to do. I completely understand why you did it. I would also have done it. And then someone hates you for doing that, and I understand why they hate you for doing that. I would also hate you for doing that.
One of the things that I really enjoyed about the show, and I'm sure this plays out in the book, is that the characters are more like D&D characters than they are your typical sort of movie or TV show characters, and that you're given an opportunity to explore all of the baggage and bullshit and sort of gray moral ground that all of these characters have. Of the main characters, there isn't a single one that doesn't get some of that. You know, like in a show like Star Trek or in a movie like Star Wars, like, oh, you get, you know, Han Solo's a rogue, and look at Geordi LaForge. He has that one episode where he's got a holodeck girlfriend, you know? But that's about all you get. And in this show, it's very, very much more.
They're fleshed out.
They're fleshed out, but you know, they're fleshed out in not even a real way. Like they're almost cartoonish in the amount of baggage that they have, but it's so integral to like what happens with the characters and the decisions they make and the bonds that they eventually form with each other that it's not your average sci-fi in that regard.
They're diametrically opposite to cardboard cutout stereotypical characters. One of the things that is often commented on when you watch Red Letter Media and they're talking about, they're doing their review or their, you know, Mike and Jay talk about, you know, they'll say something like, this character is, you know, this is frat guy character, right? And this is blonde girl character, right? Where there's one thing about them, and that is their whole character.
They have one dimension.
Yep. And these people are exactly the opposite of that, where it's like there's just like they have everything, right? There's one of every tragic thing. Like every single one of them would win on the X Factor because they all have the right kind of tragic backstory.
Yeah. And even the side characters that parachute in, at least in the show. And again, I haven't read the books. I'm getting to them. They all get more of that than side characters normally would. Ava Sarala gets a lot of that stuff. They bring in so you opened up in that kindergarten with that girl. Mm-hmm. Her father will play probably a central role for a book, you know, will be the side character for this book. And a lot of what the crew of the Rossi will do will sort of revolve around his shit. And even he gets that sort of complexity. Another character that I love, you'll probably haven't yet met, is Gunny, Bobby Draper.
Yes, actually, she is introduced in this. She is being set up to play a very central character.
Yeah.
Like you can see that coming.
Yeah. And she'll be around for quite a while and a really good arc. Anyway, watch it, read the books, watch the show. It's all fantastic. I can't say enough good things. I do have a parting gift before we wrap it up here. Technically, you have a parting gift.
Well, technically, I think that you are now more qualified to give this as a parting gift, because for me, it was literally, I had only ever seen him in shorts. And then I watched the first part of a couple of his videos and I'm like, you will enjoy this guy.
All right, let's get into it.
And I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes. Anybody want a peanut?
I'll be honest, I'm a little bit disappointed to hear that you haven't watched a lot of them.
I subscribed.
Okay, because when you sent him to me, I got a real kick out of it. And Tanya and I were joking about it the other night about how, like, I watch a lot of woodworkers and stuff, and they kind of all fit into the mold of what I would call the more modern maker. Some of them are on the artsy side. Some of them are, you know, sort of your traditional guys, but with a modern spin. They do more than just woodworking, you know, and that's not to take anything away from the guys that are just traditionalist woodworkers, but there is such a contrast at so many levels between who I'm about to introduce here And the stuff that I normally watch, that I'm like, this is the difference between Telson and I. This says so much. Like, I feel like I know you better. So I'm disappointed to find out that you haven't really been into this guy a ton. The YouTube channel is called Workshop Companion. And it's got this guy that, like, he looks like a guy that's trying to cosplay Albert Einstein as a woodworker.
He does. He really does.
But in a charming way. Like, it doesn't come off as annoying. It does come off as quite genuine. So in his own merits, I've probably watched half a dozen of his videos at this point. Informative, probably more educational. You can tell that he has a bit of an engineering background in the way that he explains stuff, but still seems to be mostly traditional woodworking from what I've seen. And I think part of the reason that I love the guy so much, and this is sort of a two-in-one parting gift, is that he reminds me of something that I used to watch as a kid. Like, I'm talking stuff from the 70s and 80s. Did you ever watch Mr. Wizard?
I did. I loved Mr. Wizard. He was great.
He was. He had a show, I think, going back to like the 50s and 60s that was in black and white. I haven't watched a lot of that stuff yet, but they did a Canadian revival in like the mid to late 70s. And then he was picked up for a bigger show back again that ran like the whole 80s called Mr. Wizard's World that I watched the shit out of. And like, he was very much a Bill Nye before Bill Nye kind of thing. Little less showy, a little less grandstandy. Again, nothing against Bill Nye, but like, Bill Nye very much had that, I'm going to try and appeal to the youths and be a little bit cool in my weird and quirky science man way, right? That makes sense for trying to attract an audience and resonate with the kids and stuff. Mr. Wizard didn't have so much of that. Like, he was very good at explaining things to children. Usually his shows featured children in them.
He is the kind of guy who would have fit in really well on the BBC. He reminds me a lot of Attenborough.
Yeah. Still doing the fun stuff. You know, you're going to get your interesting sort of safe for children science experiments and good explanations of things. And I was watching this guy, the Workshop Companion channel, and he was doing demonstrations of like glue and joints, and it all felt very much like a Mr. Wizard kind of thing in a charming and delightful way for such a quirky looking dude. I loved it, but like, it's not something that, had I just seen it pop up in my feed, I would have clicked on. I'm sure he's awesome, but probably not for me. And I'm so glad that you sent him over. I am going to go through his stuff, but it couldn't be more different than the type of shit that I watch.
Oh, I know. That's the thing, is I looked at it and I thought, like, the woodworking angle is going to be right up your street. But the guy is just like, he showed up in YouTube shorts for me, and just listening to him talk, I'm like, this is someone who deserves to be watched, yeah. Right? Because he's very much an entry level kind of channel, right? Like, he's not going to teach you about, you know, like, here's a weird jig that you can do to make stuff. It's like, here's how you use a saw kind of thing, and then gluing things and joints, basic joinery and woodworking stuff. But in such a way that you don't mind, oh, okay, like, this is kind of knee high, but still worth watching. Just because he's an entertaining guy.
He's an entertaining science teacher, not an entertaining gym teacher, you know? Like, you got the entertaining, cool gym teachers that would show by doing, and you just, you know. No, this guy stands up and he like prepares a lecture for you sometimes. But it's great. It really is great.
It really is. Do you remember there was I'm off on a bit of a tangent here, but there was a show, I think it was on PBS, and it might have been on Canadian TV. I think it was called New England Workshop. New Yankee Workshop. And there were two Norm guys, Abrams. And it's like, I remember watching it and thinking, this is back in the 90s when I was young and stupid, and thinking, I think these guys are gay. But my God, they're fun to watch. Number one Belgian block. Number one grit sandpaper. That's my favorite thing ever.
Oh, I loved listening to, because he had the accent, right? Like, he's very Boston. He had the, you know, listening to him just say dado over and over and over again. So there was two shows. There was New Yankee Workshop, which was primarily Norm Abrams. And then there was a second show that he was on with another guy called This Old House with
Bob Villa.
I don't think it was it Bob Villa? I don't think it was him. Mm-hmm. It was like a wannabe Bob Villa, I thought.
Well, Bob Villa definitely had This Old House.
Okay, maybe I'm thinking of something else. Anyway, there was a show that he was definitely on with, like, a, if it wasn't Bob Villa, it was like Kirkland Brand Bob Villa. And they had that weird dynamic, right?
Yeah.
That made and you they, like, they would, yeah.
Yeah. These guys are definitely, you know, if they're not gay, then they're hetero life mates.
Yeah.
Because they just had that vibe where these two dudes, like, they're just together.
In an era where putting that on daytime television would have been an issue, right? Like,
oh yeah. I'm absolutely certain that they got letters. And I'm just like, I mean, at the time, like, I was, like I say, I was young and stupid, so I'm sure I said some things, but I'm just like, those is and they did such great stuff. I learned so many things from that show. Mm-hmm. That was the show that actually made me want to make things.
Well, imagine New Yankee Workshop, Norm Abrams as a 75-year-old being put in a position where he's hired to teach children. You know, and you basically have this workshop companion guy. And it isn't phony. It isn't fake. It's extremely genuine. Even the intro that he plays for his long form videos just has that sort of, oh, grandpa's trying real hard tackiness to it. That's just like, good for you, dude. Good for you.
Yeah.
You know?
What's old is good.
So check it out. Two things, Workshop Companion, his YouTube channel. And also, there is an official Mr. Wizards World channel on YouTube that has pretty much all of his stuff, I think. It's got everything from the black and white era in the 50s and 60s through to the Mr. Wizards World stuff that he was doing in the 80s. I don't know if his Canadian content is on there or not, but it's of a time. You can appreciate it for its own merits, but you can also appreciate it as a bit of a time capsule.
Oh, there's some member berries in there.
And I apologize in advance if there's some sort of controversy about Mr. Wizard that I'm not aware of. That, you know, makes him a terrible person. That seems to be happening more and more whenever I think about these things from my childhood. If Norm Abrams is, you know, Jeffrey Dahmer or something like that, and I just don't know about it, I'm so very sorry. I'm speaking through the lens of, I watched this thing when I was a kid and I remember it now, 40 years later.
Yep. 40 years is a long time. You're old.
You're old. It's been good talking to you.
And you.
This is where I run the outro, I guess.
I guess so. I think we're done.
All right. I'm done. Fuck you. Well, I know you got somewhere to be, right?
I do, actually, yeah. I have to be chief tote and bottle guy, pick up and carry stuff. My wife does pottery, so I carry pottery as a hobby.